Okay, there's no way we're going to do this show without somebody getting offended. Just a warning. We'll be talking exhaustively about our waste. It'll be a miracle if the S word doesn't get said here, but I'll do our best. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. My guests promise to keep it clean as well, considering the subject. Your calls can come in now at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK toll-free, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Our email today is talk@alaskapublic.org. Wastewater Gardens, the subject on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we're back to the subject of honey buckets, and Alaskans absolutely love to talk about this issue. And we have one of the world's foremost experts, maybe the world's foremost expert on wastewater gardens with us on the show today. Mark Nelson is author of The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving Our Planet, One Flush at a Time. And he joins us by Skype from Sinigia Ranch in New Mexico. Mark, welcome to Talk of Alaska. It's an honor to have you on the show.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Am I coming through okay?
You're coming through okay, and R2-D2 has joined the conversation from time to time because of the artifact of Skype, but we'll just put up with it.
Okay.
So, Mark, I think I should tell our listeners that you are also a biospherian. You are one of those people who was underneath that, inside of that entirely closed environment in Arizona, in southern Arizona, for 2 years. In an entirely closed ecosystem, and you're the only one I've ever interviewed. It's really a pleasure to have you on, and hopefully I can get you to talk a little bit about that too.
Yeah, I always like to talk about it, and it's very relevant because how we handled, and I've been on a couple of radio interviews. NPR does not allow the S word, so we were using, I mean, it makes it sound like infants, but poo or poo power.
Yeah.
But you could can choose the euphemism you want, Steve.
Well, actually, I'm rather attracted by your the expression that you actually coined. I mean, if you think of the Earth as having a biosphere, and this enclosed environment then was called Biosphere 2, and then you can think, well, there's the geosphere and the atmosphere, the stratosphere, and then you bring up the feces sphere.
You know, Steve, you are the first person who said you like this word, so this is a milestone. Yeah, we can talk about the feces sphere, and I hope your listeners get an appreciation that what we do with the feces sphere has an enormous impact on the hydrosphere and the biosphere. So it's a good way to go. I mean, I do feel stupid. I never use the word poo in conversation aside from radio interviews.
Well, that's the way the FCC operates, buddy. We just kind of stuck with it, so we'll do what we can. The last time we did a show directly about the subject, we had a guy on as in the public health. He was a scientist in the public health area, and his main concern was that there was such a mania about sanitation and all the bad things that can happen because of honey bucket, i.e. disease in particular. So there was such an emphasis on trying to get flush toilets all over rural Alaska that nobody would talk about maybe we needed to find better ways to handle the honey buckets. And I assume you know what a honey bucket is because you've been all over the world.
Yeah, no, I'm quite familiar with the word honey bucket. And night soil, by the way, is another kind. I kind of like that term because it relates to a paradigm that we passed in Armenia for, you know, trying to keep this awful, toxic, natural substance away from ourselves. Because Nightsol at least emphasizes that the traditional and best use of this stuff is to build soil and to feed plants.
One of the places where you worked around the world and that you talk about in all of the various locations you worked in the book, The Wastewater Gardener, one of the places was, and I know you've been back there several times, in the Yucatan Peninsula along the coast, where there's a lot of tourists, and everybody wants to make everything nice for the tourists. And you talk about building wastewater garden there and discovering that the workers were going, when they needed to, quote, go, were actually going into the mangroves when they could. And that was really not bad. That, in a lot of ways, was better than the septic systems that were at these resorts.
Yeah, I think that's a great example of, you know, prejudices that we carry around. And, you know, I think, and the sanitary engineers who put in flush toilets and centralized sewage, you know, they weren't bad people. The paradigm then was, you know, untreated feces are causing an enormous amount of illness and death. You know, let's get it away from people, let's put it to a centralized factory, and that's the best solution. And of course, at the end of that process, they dump it. They dump the, quote, treated and now chlorinated feces material into the nearest body of water. So yeah, down in the Yucatan, we had these, you know, wealthy gringos, i.e. Americans and Europeans, with their fancy houses and their flush toilets. And, you know, they're sitting on a limestone, you know, basically limestone rock. And everything that goes into the limestone, and a lot of their septic tanks were completely unlined to make that contact even faster, went immediately out to the coral reefs. That was, you know, both the attraction for them being there and the economic base of tourism. You know, so it was a terrible situation, unbelievable. And whereas they're Mayan workers who don't have the, you know, convenience of flush toilets, were actually going out into the only area that actually had soil that could absorb and make use of this material. So it was very ironic indeed.
But, you know, it turns out that that's a great place for it. I mean, ecologically, the mangroves are perfectly capable of handling this.
Yeah, I mean, the mangroves, like all wetlands, I mean, it's one of the reasons I have this, which I describe in the book, this love affair with wetlands, both natural and constructed, is wetlands seriously are the kidneys of the planet. They have amazing abilities to buffer and to purify all kinds of both man-made and natural potential pollutants. And that's why they fringe, you know, most coastlines. They fringe lakes, and they fringe rivers. That they're an enormously useful product. So constructed wetlands and my wastewater gardens are basically paying homage to natural wetlands and saying, well, you know, if we understand how nature does it, we can engineer these things and we can make them really small for an individual house. We can make them for cities of, you know, 20, 50, 100,000 people. Actually, there's no limit, but you need land. And you can then have the properties that wetland soils and plants do work. So yeah, the Mayans going out in the mangroves was the perfect place to go, because there they had made peat soils that were just soaking up those feces and making them available for the mangroves.
And what's happening then is that all these microorganisms are essentially going to work. So for instance, if I were to go in the woods, right, they say, well, the best way is just make a little hole with the heel of your boot and go right in there and put the turf back on top of it, and it'll reincorporate right into the natural environment.
Yeah. You know, the only proviso, way back, our populations were small, nomadic, etc., there was really not a problem. The biosphere, the hydrosphere could incorporate. I mean, it's not like we're defecating toxic waste. We're part of the natural cycle. All animals are, goes through our gut, comes out perfectly wonderful fertilizer with all the bacteria needed to break it down and make it available for other microbes and for plants to incorporate. It's just, now that we have the populations that are concentrated, and we can talk more about indoor plumbing, its benefits and drawbacks, we're mixing our wonderful fertilizer with an enormous amount of, and this is really a shame, perfectly potable fresh water. And we're using 10 tons of this really precious resource to flush one ton of our waste away. So it's a very crazy and the essence of unsustainable situation.
Well, I entitled this program Peak Water because of that, because I've been told by scientists that we're at or possibly passing peak water. In other words, the amount of water that we can actually make use of and consume without it, getting back to its own tail.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when I started in this field of, doing constructed wetlands, we call them wastewater gardens because unlike, let me just kindly put out, somewhat imagination-limited engineers who think that efficiency is the only measure of a system. So they make reed beds or they'll find one plant or at most two plants and call it a day. I thought that making wetlands gives you an opportunity to make them beautiful, to make them productive, to make them wildlife attractors and provide feed for wildlife, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of just making a constructed wetland, we want to make a beautiful, man-made wetland to do the purpose.
And so you have, and you brag actually several times, almost redundant, I think, in the book of how often there will be people sitting at a table enjoying a meal or a beverage or a coffee right next to a pretty garden, and they're sitting there because they like the garden and they don't realize what's under the surface there.
Yeah, in this business, if people don't know that that's sewage treatment, you've done your job really well. I mean, I often give talks and I like to just throw up a whole series of pictures of these beautiful wastewater gardens and just say to people, that is a sewage treatment plant. And it's actually more efficient than those expensive things that have all the machinery and use chemicals and usually if they aren't maintained really well, don't work worth a damn anyway, but are certainly not going to last more than 10 years. These systems get better as the plants get more established.
So, you're really passionate about this, Mark, and I imagine you're pretty proud of this book. How is it doing?
Well, it's doing really well. We've gotten great reviews all over the place, including New Scientist and Nature, my God, which is pretty awesome. I mean, They chose it for one of their books in brief, but they only choose 5 science-related books, in each issue. So, no, it's been moving really well. I think it's hitting a bit of a chord because I think, it kind of ties into why I'm passionate about it. And let me give you a little anecdote from Biosphere 2, which kind of, motivated me to go and get some advanced degrees in the field and start doing it. One of my jobs in Biosphere 2 was being the sewage manager, which meant, taking care of our constructed wetland. We worked with a wonderful and very pioneering NASA scientist, a very creative guy who also is responsible for houseplants cleaning up indoor air. And people were just, I could see how, incredulous they were that here's this Jewish kid from New York City with sickle in hand, going into these systems and harvesting the plants, which then went to our domestic animals and put more food on our table. And I was realizing they were like in, that shock of astonishment because first off, the feces sphere is seriously a taboo. Most people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. And maybe they have a guilty suspicion that what we're doing is really messed up about it. And I thought, well, you know, if I could do these systems around the world, this is going to contact people with this basic reality. And what we were experiencing in Biosphere 2 is the immense pleasure that you get, satisfaction, I mean, really deep cellular, when you understand that you're part of a system and a constructive part, and you understand how that works, where your water is coming from, where your wastes are going. And of course, in Biosphere 2, it was a perfect system because the fodder, you know, the plants being grown in the constructed wetlands fed our domestic animals, and the nutrients we sent back to our farm. So all of the food nutrients that came from our farm went back to it.
So Mark, that I want to go into that science a little bit about Biosphere 2, because what you had, I think, was a careful selection of what species to include, but the aim was to have different biomes of the planet represented, and then to actually close it completely, and that would essentially create a speeded up cycle. So it was very important, as I understand it, to keep toxins out of there because they would bioconcentrate in no time. But everything, you know, the oxygen, everything was cycling really, really fast compared to the planetary process.
Yeah, even though we made the roofs as high as, you know, kind of realistically feasible, I mean, a 75-foot rainforest sky is quite a different than the, what, you know, 60 to 100 kilometers that we have until you actually get into space. So, yeah, it was like my colleague John Allen, who called it a cyclotron for the life sciences, because everything was speeded up because we had such a concentration of life, such small amounts of water. We had a mini ocean, but, you know, 40 feet wide, 20 feet deep, and 100 feet long is, you know, basically an Olympic swimming pool and a tiny atmosphere. So our carbon cycle was sped up hundreds of times over the leisurely pace it has in our global biosphere. So the one purpose of Biosphere 2 is to be a laboratory for sort of global ecology. We made a mini biosphere, very much with a tropical bent. And in that system, we could really study all of the cycling, the interactions, which are very paralleled to what happens in the global environment.
We're speaking with Mark Nelson. He's the author of The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time. I guess I should call you Dr. Mark Nelson, because you are. You put a lot of work into getting your degree, your doctorate, I think, from Florida, right? Gainesville, under Odom?
Yeah, but please don't call me doctor. I got the PhD, you know, one, because working with H.T. Odom, he and his brother Gene revolutionized ecology. They introduced systems ecology, which, you know, is an amazingly productive way of thinking about and researching ecology. But he was also the father of what's now being called ecological engineering. And in fact, constructed wetlands are a beautiful example of that kind of ecological engineering. Steve, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, I just heard some strange computer sound here.
Well, as I said, R2-D2 is interjecting from time to time through a digital artifactual process. It is not well understood by any of us, but we'll just put up with it. The phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org, or talking to one of the original biospherians here, Mark Nelson, and he went into the wastewater gardening business big time afterwards. And you had a lot of biomes in there. You have put wastewater gardens in a number of different biomes, but I don't think you've reached subarctic yet. And I'm wondering if it's possible even.
You know, I was thinking that this question obviously is going to come up, and I'm looking forward. I've never been in your beautiful part of the world up there in Alaska. But, you know, we have a group of regional affiliates that, you know, with my supervision and training, put in these systems around the world. And I was thinking in the Carpathian Mountains, this is right on the border with Slovakia and Ukraine and is on the Polish side. They have winters that go down to minus 30 Fahrenheit. So, you know, the systems work. We've done a number of systems there for small towns, people, and into a couple of national parks using native polar species. So, you know, these systems actually perform well. I mean, there's a lot of work. If you Google constructed wetlands, there's a lot of work that, you know, is being done in Canada. A lot of the modern pioneers were working in northern Germany. So unless the entire constructed wetland freezes, and as we know, the really good thing about water is it freezes at the top, which actually insulates the rest of the constructed wetland, it's been done in really, really harsh winter climates.
Well, I really think a demonstration project up here in one of our villages would be a very, very educational and interesting thing. And, you know, it's interesting when I follow the narrative of your work since you left Biosphere 2 in what, 90-something or other?
Well, 94, I was working with the second crew when the direction of the project, let us say, changed.
Yeah, so ever since then, you've been on this path pretty much through your education and everything, and rather quickly got into making more wastewater gardens, such as you really had inside the greenhouse there. And now you've discovered that it catches on. You discovered that once you showed that it worked and saved people money in terms of their sewage treatment and their penalties for treating the environment poorly, that you would have imitators. And so there are some communities, as I understand it, where this is now the majority way that that sewage is dealt with, as opposed to the other way of the centralized treatment plant.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and it's kind of nice to evoke, you know, the best kind of jealousy is when someone tries to imitate you. You know, back to ecological engineering, a lot of people, because we live in a very technophilic society, look at a constructed wetland or even worse, you know, a beautiful wastewater garden, and they say, oh, that's really, you know, that's really nice. But if we want serious sewage treatment, you know, let's go get some aerators and chemicals and do the modern technical stuff. And they're kind of amazed. And every time we work in a new country, one, we will really want to, you know, verify how these systems are doing. We do a series of water tests, and we far exceed in general secondary standards that's municipal city standards. But I do want to say, Steve, that, you know, it's not one solution. There are a lot of really innovative ways that are being advanced: gray water recycling, composting toilets. If the ecology and the groundwater is not close, if the groundwater is not close to the surface, you don't necessarily have to have a constructed wetland. But what I'm saying is, if you do have the septic tank and flush toilets, what you want to do is get plants to be intercepting and using what comes out of that septic tank. So, you know, depending on the circumstance, constructed wetlands is not always the best solution.
Let's go back to that technophile thing, because there's a very, very telling quote in there from Russian space habitat specialist. And I know you just got back from Russia, and you probably know all the people that have lived in and dealt with closed environments in the Russian space program, Mark. And they had a different procedure. They had the notion that you can trust machinery to break down and natural things to progress, to advance, sort of the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, especially that time, but NASA hasn't changed. And yeah, I mean, there used to be a group called the Mars Underground advocating Mars exploration. There's also kind of a biological life support underground. And it, unfortunately, is kind of a small group. The Chinese are doing the most interesting stuff. But, you know, NASA in particular, they, you know, after Sputnik, when they got into a race with the Soviet Union, you know, to go to the stars and all that, they started working with biological life support. But they wanted to have as little life as they could get away with, and they wanted to control it totally. And when they found that green algae was pretty good at regenerating air and water, but you couldn't feed more than about an ounce of it to your your astronauts or your crew members without them getting sick, they seriously just stopped the program for 20 years. Whereas the Soviets, the Russians, their space visionaries understood, you know, if we're going to leave the planetary cradle and take our baby steps into the solar system, we need space greenhouses. So when they came to the same point, they said, okay, great, we'll use higher plants. But still, the space agencies and most of the other people are still in a we want to control everything kind of mode. And you can understand this because safety of, you know, your astronauts, your cosmonauts is number one. And undoubtedly, when we go into space, we're going to go in with a lot of physical, chemical backup, you know, but for us to actually live in space and orbiting space stations or eventually on Moon and Mars, we have to learn how to recycle everything. So I've always been really passionate and enthused that the long-term future of space has great similarities with learning how to live sustainably on planet Earth. Because, you know, like you're saying about Biosphere 2, once you make a really tightly sealed system and think about space, where you have a precious atmosphere, you really want to keep it inside, then you have to figure out how to recycle everything and how not to use poisonous substances and have some biology that can absorb any byproducts of the machinery that you're going to have to use. So it's a wonderful kind of way of thinking that parallels very much what we're beginning to face up to in our global challenge.
It seems that there's two sides of it. As the last time that we went into this subject on this program, there's the one side of here's your natural environment and what it can do and what you could do with it and all that. And then the other side is not wanting to look at the alternative. The other side is not wanting to look at the fact that your septic tank leaks, that you're on limestone and it's porous, that you didn't get it pumped out, so it's really not doing its job anyway. And where do you think that stuff is going anyway? And on and on. I mean, it seems like we just don't want to look at any of that.
Well, you know, and let's also introduce, because I would assume you may have problems with the native populations there. I really don't know the story, but there's two sides to the insanity of our current dealing or not dealing with sewage. In the West, we spend enormous resources. I mean, enormous. A new sewage plant I just heard in LA was going to cost $4 billion. And then it's going to cost a ton to operate with all the pumping stations. So we're throwing enormous resources at it. We're wasting incredible amounts of water, which are then basically dumped into the nearest body of water and very problematical biosolids is the euphemism, because we're mixing industry and commercial enterprises with good, clean residential feces. We have this really hazardous material that farmers are quite reluctant to use. So, but then on the flip side, in the developing world, the situation is beyond appalling. I think the, you know, latest UN estimates are that 90% of all sewage, all human waste in the developing, the poor countries, is not treated at all. And that's why they have amazing rates of disease, you know, cholera, typhoid, but let's start with diarrhea, because that those feces get into their drinking water. So we have, you know, we have two coins. We have amazing waste of water and waste of resources and not recuperating, reclaiming, putting back into sustainable use the nutrients. And then we have this just flat out total catastrophe. And then, you know, couple that, you were talking about peak water. You know, one thing to just put in your mind is that if everyone on the planet had a flush toilet, even a water efficient one, and tried to flush their toilets, we wouldn't have enough water to do that.
So, all right, Mark, now I know that I think the number one public health problem in the world is dehydration due to the wrong microorganisms being in your system. A lot of that comes from improper handling of the human sewage. I know that. And and people having no choice. I'm just wondering, So here are these whatevers, these E. coli or whatever that are pathogens that are causing diarrhea for children. And what happens to those microorganisms when they go into a wastewater garden? I mean, they don't just go away, do they?
Well, no, they don't just go away. But, let's start with these pathogens want to live in your gut, in a human gut or an animal gut. They don't like being out in a constructed wetland, first off. So just with time.
They don't like it.
It's killing them. And then, even better than that, there are a lot of microorganisms that will feed on those pathogens. So just in the wastewater garden, when we've done, been able to get samples down to laboratories to do these tests, and the literature confirms this, you get 99, plus percent reduction of these pathogens. E. coli is just the indication that you have sewage pollution. And then if you further use the treated wastewater from your wastewater garden and do a lot of subsurface irrigation, the death rate continues. But the big thing I want to make, you're talking about the sanitary engineers who are saying this stuff is really dangerous and people aren't, that's why you have to have some engineering and ecology to set up systems that really are safe. I mean, it's no joke. Human waste improperly treated is a disaster, is very disease causing. So what I love about, the particular approach that I use and all ones that make sense is you're minimizing the contact or eliminating the accidental contact of humans with this stuff. This stuff only gets harmful if it gets into groundwater untreated or if it hits a human hand or gets into water supply and gets drunk. So I work with constructed wetlands that are, it's called subsurface flow. Means that we have a dry layer of about 2 inches of gravel above the wastewater, so there's no accidental contact, and that's why they don't smell as well. So any system that deals with human waste has got to meet these sort of common sense ideas of keeping people and other animals away from this wastewater.
We're talking with Mark Nelson, author of The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving Our Planet One Flush at a Time, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA healthcare benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal healthcare facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA.
It's primary election day, a very important election in Alaska today, and it has absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the subject that I've chosen for Talk of Alaska today, which is dealing with our human waste, the feces sphere, as Mark Nelson calls it. And he's with us today by Skype from New Mexico. He was a biospherian. He was in a closed environment, a closed, complete ecosystem, for 2 years and survived to tell us the story. He's the guy that dealt with the wastewater in there, and now he finds he can't stop dealing with wastewater. We're ready, I think, for some questions. So let's go first to Mark, who joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Mark. Mark?
Thank you, Steve, for taking my call, and this is a great topic. Mr. Nelson, I wanted to ask, just from your experience, what are the best arguments that you could pose to use with policymakers for leapfrogging past the whole centralized treatment model to a system of many small treatment plants. And the reason I'm asking is out where I live, which is, you know, the size of West Virginia, we're considering, you know, many millions of dollars to build one regional treatment plant. And I think it, I personally think it would be better to go now to a system of many small treatment plants. But of course, policymakers and engineers, they typically look at the, you know, the last 40 years. So I'll take my answer off the air, but I'd like to know some of the best arguments to use with policymakers. Is it money? Is it something else? Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And Mark, you have the floor.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is a happy topic because you can start with an economic analysis. And these kind of dinosaur centralized sewage treatment plants, they're enormously expensive. And especially, you know, it sounds like your questioner is not in a densely urban area. All the pumping stations that you have to put to bring, you know, scattered population into one sewage treatment plant costs a fortune to construct and maintain.
Yeah, so what they have, what the situation is, people are often on septic, but because there's like permafrost and things like that, septic can be problematical. But they don't like the outhouse very much. So the thought is when the population starts getting more dense, that's the point where you start putting some infrastructure in there for centralized treatment.
Well, you know, one of my principles, and as I mentioned before, I'm really not a one-note Johnny, like, you know, one solution is going to work everywhere in the world. But, you know, treating sewage more locally and trying to green, you know, and purify it ecologically costs way less money. And there's a great example, actually, that when I was doing my dissertation, my research for my degree, I came across the Tennessee Valley Authority, not really radical environmentalists generally. They run the power infrastructure in a lot of southern states. They had a great program in the 80s and 90s dealing with the problems. You know, what you're talking about is septic tanks are designed to work with soils that, you know, can purify the water. They're not designed to work septic tanks into a leach drain area where the water is too high, will not work, or if it's rocky soil. And that was the case for thousands of the homes that they were servicing with power. So they subsidized, you know, individual homeowners building small constructed wetlands, because then you can, you know, a constructed wetland, as I was mentioning, is going to remove 99%+ of the potential pathogens. It's going to reduce the organic matter by 90%, it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there are examples, even in the United States, of a large agency, I think that's state and federally funded, implementing a huge small-scale solution rather than going with the centralized one single sewage treatment plant.
Okay, Mark, there's a couple of arguments you could use, and cost, I think, would be the big one. We're talking with Mark Nelson, author of The Wastewater Gardener. He's discussing constructed wetlands, among other things, and Don in Petersburg chimes in, what about things that go through the human body and end up in the waste? What about, like, medications that people take, antibiotics, tranquilizers. Sometimes this can be a problem in water.
Yeah, I mean, that is a problem. And quite frankly, I am not, as we would say in Australia, full bottle on this topic. That's a problem. And I understand that residues of these medications and hormones and whatnot are getting into drinking water supplies in many U.S., maybe most U.S., cities now. All I can say is that when you have a regional small scale, I mean, I'm really for not necessarily doing it one house at a time, but thinking about communities and seeing how you might make a constructed wetland that would serve 50 or 100 or, you know, whatever the terrain and common sense allows you to. If you make an analysis and you make sure that that wastewater doesn't get dumped into something that's going to come back into drinking water, the problem becomes kind of mute. These substances aren't the greatest thing, but they're a reality in our life. it's much better to decentralize. I mean, the problem with centralized sewage treatment is you got the residues of, you know, 500,000 to 5 million people, depending on the size of your city, being concentrated. And, you know, this hasn't changed. They will dump it into whatever body of water is most convenient. And that's likely to then go get taken into your drinking water. So a lot of the solutions, and it's kind of aligned with you know, what a lot of people thinking about sustainability is, forget about these macro, you know, huge centralized solutions. They create problems, you know, that they were designed to solve one problem, but the unintended consequences, you know, really bite you in the butt. No pun intended, since we're talking about butts today. So I think the best answer about these medications is decentralized, regional, community. You know, maybe in a city, if you have land, this is the real catch on constructed wetlands. You need area. So can we do it in New York City? I don't know, unless we bite the bullet and pump it out into a green area of New Jersey or Connecticut. You're certainly not going to do it with real estate being that valuable. But I think in Alaska, you guys have different set of issues, and probably there's space around your cities.
There is one basic rule, right, Mark, that the lower the temperature, the bigger area you basically have to have?
Fortunately, this is why I love working in the tropics. One, because, you know, the people in the developing world can't afford those crazy techno solutions. But yeah, in a really cold climate, you're going to use two or three times the space or the area per person that you would in the tropics.
All right, thanks. Well, we're talking with Mark Nelson. The phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. From Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422, and email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And while I'm with you here, Mark, I want to bring up Biosphere 2. I'm going to go back to that for a moment, because I asked you about this one time, and I'm loving being able to interview you about this on the air. But you said that the Russians coming out of a closed environment, and you, Biosphereans, had the same experience when you took the seals off and you came out, what it smelled like. And the words you used were, it stank. In other words, your biosphere didn't stink, but when you opened it up, it stank out there.
Yeah, I hate to say, you know, I mean, the people around Biosphere 2, you know, I don't think they totally got on some wavelength. So after we did our re-entry, that's what we called it, after the 2 years coming back, they put us on a little golf cart, and we had some ones that were run by solar and whatnot. They put us on one with a conventional engine motor. And, you know, we hadn't smelled the exhaust of a car for 2 years. And I have to say, it was absolutely disgusting. It's kind of like, what are you people thinking out here? You know, we had a visit. It was one of the surreal moments. You know, we were pretty headlined for those 2 years from 91 to 93. So Mr. Toyota himself from Japan came with quite an entourage. And literally, sometimes you can't make this stuff up. It's funnier than fiction. He said, I really like your project. I really like Biosphere 2. But I'm so sad that you haven't included one of my cars in there. And we were too polite to say, if we did, we'd probably be out of there because the air would be unbreathable, or we could stay in here and die. So, yeah, Biosphere 2 was designed to be really, really low pollution. We were like spacecraft engineers. Every machine and every material that went into Biosphere 2 had to meet this test. What is it outgassing, and can the life systems in Biosphere take care of it? And I have to say that, you know, this was the insight. I have another book to write about Biosphere 2, because it was an amazing project. And, you know, the images went out around the world, and I think, you know, people galvanized to it. But there's so many great stories and insights that came out of that I really want to share with people. But one was, you know, and this is Russian thinking about the biosphere. They say, you know, we humans, we've created a technosphere. And, you know, you can summarize the major challenge of the 21st century and on is, can we harmonize that technosphere with our biosphere? And can we understand that this is not a trivial question, because that biosphere is, hello, people, our life support system?
Can we harmonize it? Mark, that's a fantastic question, and I think we'll take the break right on that note as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Mark Nelson, I've invited a couple of other guests here, and I did that because they are the owners of a closed household system. And even though they're up in Fairbanks picking berries right now, because you do seasonal things this time of year in Alaska, they consented to come to a telephone and talk to us about their Eagle River property, and they may have some questions for you. But let me introduce either Kurt or Cindy Carnes, whichever one picks up the phone.
We're both on, and we're on the speaker.
Okay, that's great. Hi, Kurt. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, and Cindy. And maybe you could just get a very brief discussion of the bioshelter. And I know people can take tours if they want sometimes.
Right. We're doing walkthrough Wednesdays this month, and so actually tomorrow evening at 7 they can tour. But it's a closed system house in that the water comes in off of the roof. It's cleaned by plants. It goes into our cistern. We use the water, and then it's cleaned by bacteria, runs into a fish pond, and then goes through the wetlands, of course, and then back into the cistern again. So we reuse our water, and our waste then is recycled and put back into the gardens through the help of worms. And so as we're not like Biosphere 2, but because we can go out and gather our fish and our moose and different and our berries at this time of year, our house is very unique.
Yeah, Cindy, because I'm Facebook friends with you, I know that you you came home to find problems with your fish a while ago, and you knew there would be problem with your water because of that.
Exactly. We had 16 people at a workshop, and that turned out to be so much water going through the system, it didn't have enough time to clean it, and the fish died, and so we had to stop using the water for a little bit, and we're now just still trying to balance the system again. So it's really a difficult thing to try to be the caretaker or the integrated into this natural system.
And Mark Nelson, to include you in the conversation here, this is an issue you go into in your book, The Wastewater Gardener, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time, and that is maintenance. You can't just let this stuff sit. You actually have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, you know, there's great satisfaction when, you know, as your people are saying, you know, when you understand the importance of it, you're motivated.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to see if you guys wanted to interact. So, Mark, maybe you can. Do you have any questions or anything for Kurt and Cindy?
Well, I'm just kind of curious because I've been working in this field, and the paradigm, and my God, even the regulations, and occasionally the minds of health regulators are beginning to expand from their, you know, no. So, gray water recycling, you know, used to earn you a potential jail sentence in Australia. Now they're subsidizing it, and they're kind of making it more complicated than it should be. But, you know, the things have really changed. I'm curious, did you have any problem with health regulators to do gray water and do the kind of systems and integration you're talking about?
Might be a touchy question.
Yeah. Well, part of the issue for us is where we live. We live in Eagle River Valley, and at the time the house was built, it was out in the country, which meant it didn't have some of the same regulations that you might have in the Muni. And then when the Muni expanded its boundaries, we find ourselves within their area. And so basically we're grandfathered in, but they don't allow new systems to be built that way. But what was interesting for us was that the state of Alaska, when we bought this back in 2007, they were saying, you know, we'd really like to be the energy state. We'd like to be energy, not just oil, but also renewables, and we'd like to really create living ways of living in houses that have all sorts of green ways of living. And so when we went to buy it, we discovered that the Alaska Housing Association would not approve our loan. And so Cindy was so diligent, she contacted the legislators and said, what do you mean? You just said you want, we got a house that's doing what you say you want, and Alaska Housing Authority won't allow us to have a loan. And so they ended up conferring and talking to the Alaska Housing Authority. They finally said, okay, if you can get an environmental engineer to sign off that it's safe, we'll approve the loan. And so that's what happened. So it practically took an act of Congress to be able to even get the loan.
And we wouldn't have this house except for Lauren Lehman really, really helped us out. So kudos to him.
Yeah, he was the engineer who came down. I was with him, and in my opinion, he had more fun looking at it than it wasn't just a job. He spent a lot more time there than he really had to because he just loved looking at the system.
That is really, really cool. I mean, that only on Talk of Alaska when you hear that. So I really appreciate that. I want to go back to the calls. You guys can stay on the line if you would, please. And we'll go to Kay, joins the program, been waiting quite a while from Juneau. You're on there with Mark Nelson, Kay.
Hi, Steve and Mark. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm concerned about the fact that we have a huge water and sewer challenge going on in our state. The Department of Environmental Conservation has been working for over a year putting together this water and sewer challenge where they're reattempting to deal with the major problems in rural communities in Alaska for handling human waste and getting clean water, potable water, into people's homes. But we're not talking about big cities here. We're talking about places the size of Akiachak and Aniak and places like that, you know, with 300 or 400 people maybe at the most, or 500. And we've already spent millions of dollars on water and sewer, centralized water and sewer facilities that haven't worked for a variety of reasons that I will not go into. But I've done a lot of work in rural communities, and the health problems in these communities are serious. There's a lot of pneumonia, there's meningitis, there's staphylococcus that kids get from a scratch or a cut and then doing steam baths, and so they get these bad staph infections in some communities. And many communities don't have running water in their homes. And there have been a variety of small solutions that seem to have worked, and the state has now chosen six agencies or groups or people to actually work on this challenge for the second phase, I believe. But the issue that mainly concerns me is the issue of permafrost and the whole business of digging in the ground in places where there is permafrost and where we also have melting permafrost. So I don't know, Mark, if you have anything to say about building these kinds of systems that you're working on and that Cindy and Kurt have done in their home in a place where there's permafrost. And that seems to me to be a major issue.
All right, well, let me throw two things in. First off, as you know, because the permafrost has been melting more than it used to, they've taken to putting insulation in between the gravel and so forth that they laid down for construction and the permafrost to keep it from degrading, A. So you could do that. And then B, I think at some point you got to put a roof over it. It's just simple as that. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know the ins and outs of permafrost, but I'm thinking, you know, maybe your listeners don't realize, but let's make it sure, underneath all constructed wetlands, unless you want to put the clean water back into the aquifer, you have a liner, a pond liner in countries with very inexpensive local labor. We do it out of concrete. And we have done a number of projects kind of similar in a way. We actually had to dig into the groundwater, pump it out while we put our liners in. But once you put the liner in, it seems to me that your constructed wetland would be floating. But you know, I think you know engineers in Alaska who really know the ins and out of permafrost and the issues it causes need to think about that. But I was thinking about that when I was telling the example about the TVA. You know, it's somewhat similar, I believe. Permafrost, you have groundwater, you know, because of the melting ice so close to the surface. That's similar to a lot of the systems we've done and the issues that the TVA was trying to alleviate. Because picture it, that, you know, that small constructed wetland for a community or cluster of houses has a liner, and then the biology is going to, you know, largely detoxify and take care of the problem pathogens before it goes out for any further use.
And let me throw this in too, Mark, that in no way are you opposing running water. You like running water, as I understand it.
I find the I also wanted to say, you know, constructed wetlands might be reserved for blackwater. And if you've got, I mean, it's cold here in New Mexico in the wintertime, and I've dealt with outhouses. You know, there's a lot of conveniences to indoor plumbing. We shouldn't be sending that out to sewage treatment plants anyway, or to constructed wetlands. We should be separating the plumbing, because gray water is infinitely easier to use as irrigation, much less harmful than black water. And then you're only dealing with the black water in your sewage treatment, whichever choice you come up with.
Kay, anything more you want to throw in? We're almost out of time. Oh, we lost Kay. Yeah, Kurt and Cindy, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Anything you want to add?
It was a pleasure to be here, even though it was short. We got plenty of blueberries, so that's good.
The one thing I would add is that there are some systems that end up not needing to put things back into the ground very much. Our system is almost a closed system, and it would work in a village as well as city, but it does require a certain level of maintenance that's a little awkward. So it takes some talk about what would really work in the village, but there are systems that don't require putting it back into the tundra and would avoid the...
I would say that this was built as a prototype for Western Alaska.
Okay, we're out of time. Mark Nelson, thanks so much.
Thank you all.
All right, Wastewater Gardener is available from Synergetic Press.
Possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2014 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.